I hope you're enjoying this podcast of an earlier broadcast of In the Market with Janet Parshall. And I do want to thank you so much for joining us for the program. I also want to take this opportunity to remind you that my brand new book, Buyer Beware, Finding Truth in the Marketplace of Ideas, is now available. I'm so excited about this book. It really takes a look at the hostile culture in which we live and reminds us through the words of Jeremiah how we can live abundantly. In fact, not just survive, but thrive abundantly because of the promises that God has given us. So I hope you'll pick up your copy of Buyer Beware. You can do it at your local bookstore or online. And thanks so much for joining us for In the Market with Janet Parshall. Fascinating conversation with Matt Staver about all of the challenges working their way up to the United States Supreme Court. And really, as we talk about oral arguments now being set for March 26th and 27th on both Prop 8 and DOMA, it's a perfect setup to our conversation that we're about to have now. I have a question for you. Do you ever think, by the way, that you'd ever in a gazillion trillion years have to find yourself in the marketplace of ideas offering a defense for marriage? It's one of those, duh. Well, I kind of never thought I'd have to do that. But you know what? Here's what Mordecai said to Esther, and maybe his words should ring in our ears today. Who knows? But perhaps we've been called for such a time as this. So if we're supposed to know what we believe and why we believe it, if we're supposed to give an intelligent defense for marriage, could you do it? Could you do it? I don't mean just quoting Bible verses. That's extremely important because, after all, it wasn't a bunch of judges or politicians or public policy wonks who came up with the definition. It was, in fact, God. You don't have to wade into the scriptures farther than your ankles to understand who defined marriage. But let's say you're talking to someone who is a non-believer, an atheist, an agnostic, and gags and sputters and chokes and says, give me a defense outside of scripture. Can you do that? Could you? Well, we're going to talk with Ryan Anderson, who's the William E. Simon Fellow in Religion and Free Society at the Heritage Foundation. And by the way, this is a very learned individual. He is not only the fellow at Heritage, but he's the editor of Public Discourse, Ethics, Law, and the Common Good. That's the online journal of the Witherspoon Institute. He's a Phi Beta Kappa and magnum cum laude graduate of Princeton, a PhD candidate in political philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, which means he's got a whole lot of book learning. But why did you decide to take this book up? The book is called What is Marriage, Man and Woman, a Defense? Why'd you tackle this, Ryan?
Because it needed to be done. This book needed to be written. My two co-authors, one was a classmate of mine at Princeton, one was a professor of ours at Princeton. And what we realized was that there were people of goodwill who had the right gut instinct. They knew in their hearts that marriage was between a man and a woman. And they knew that the Bible told them that marriage was between a man and a woman. But they didn't know how to make secular arguments, philosophical arguments, social science arguments, arguments that would persuade someone who didn't agree with them as to why marriage is the union of a man and a woman. And so we set ourselves the task of investigating, you know, but why is it that every culture that has left a record of itself has recognized marriage as the union of a man and a woman? Not just Christian cultures, not just Jewish cultures, but the ancient Romans and the ancient Greeks and Enlightenment cultures, everyone that we can have a record of has understood marriage as a male-female union. And there's a reason for that. And that's what we articulate in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the way you break it down. And you start out by talking about two views. And I laugh because I think this is deja vu all over again. We've got the doctrine of original intent in the Constitution, and we have the concept that it's elastic. Now we've got the doctrine of original intent as marriage being a man and a woman, or we have this revisionist idea. So let me go to the revisionist for a moment, and let me play the devil's advocate. If you're going to give the historical argument, of which I think the evidence, there's a preponderance of evidence, you know you're going to get people are going to say, yes, but. It's the yes, but argument. Yes, but you had polygamy in the Old Testament. And yes, but we've seen polyamorphous relations throughout history. And yes, but history records dot, 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 fill in the blank. Let me start with the exceptions before we go to the evidence. What do you do with the yes, but arguments when people point out the exceptions as their defense?
Sure. I mean, one way of even thinking about that is to actually look how Jesus answered such a question. Mm. So you think he's questioned about whether or not marriage is supposed to be a permanent relationship. And they say, well, didn't Moses allow us to get divorces? And he says, yes, because of the hardness of your hearts, Moses granted you the bill of divorce. But from the beginning, it was not so. And what's the reference in from the beginning? It goes back to the Genesis passage, Genesis 2, right? And the from the beginning idea goes back to creation. And so one of the arguments we want to make is like, all right, well, let's understand what marriage is in its nature, not the various concessions that various societies have. You know, different societies have gotten it more or less correct different societies have had to make various concessions around the edges. But as far as we know, no society has ever missed the central truth that marriage is about bringing a man and a woman together as husband and wife to be father and mother to the children that their union produces. No one's missed that point. And that it's only within the past 20 years that this has even been on the table as something that's up for debate.
Exactly.
So and that's why we said, you know, let's go back to the nature, the title of the book, What is Marriage? Let's get back to that question. And then we can talk about all these exceptions, you know, all the outliers.
Yeah, I like that. So let me go to the cornerstone culture. In fact, it's interesting because you look back at some of the writers of history, the cornerstone institution of any vibrant, thriving society, it seems to me, is in fact marriage. But let me fast forward to the 21st century for a minute, because I know you hear this all the time, as do I, Ryan, and that is, okay, step away from the biblical idea that marriage is a covenant. It's this promise made in the presence of witnesses before God. It's this profundity of this representation of Christ's love for the church and all of those things that we know as Christians. And let me step that aside for a moment, and let me just simply go to the concept of contract law. And you put this question forward in the book, and I think it's an extremely important one. Does the state have a right to regulate some relationships?
Oh, not only does the state have the right to do so, I mean, we actually think the state has the duty to do so. And there's a simple reason. The state doesn't care about my romantic life just in terms of my romance. The state doesn't care about my best friend. It doesn't care about intimate personal relationships just as such. The state cares about marriage because the sexual act between a man and a woman frequently produces, 9 months later, a very needy, very dependent, totally helpless new life. And the state has the obligation to make sure that new life is cared for, protected, and raised to maturity. And now the state can either try to do this itself, right? So the state can try to be father to the orphan, discipliner to the misbehaving, you know, and all the rest, right? So the state can try to raise kids, or the state can, with you know, a lot less intrusively, a lot less coercively, incentivize men and women to commit to each other and to then take responsibility for the kids that they make. And that's why it's in the marriage business. Not because it cares about romance and, you know, butterflies in the stomach and all of that. It cares about marriage because the sexual act produces kids and the state needs these kids to be reared well. So it's not surprising that as we saw the marriage culture fall apart in the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. That's when we saw the welfare state explode. It's when we saw our prison populations explode. It's where we saw an increase in poverty and a decrease in social mobility. All four of those factors are correlated with the breakdown of the married mom and dad family. And that's why it's really a social justice issue that the state needs to encourage men and women to commit and to take responsibility. And there's no other way of doing it besides marriage.
So let me go back to the idea of children, because you make this argument. Maggie Gallagher, of course, the case for marriage, makes the same argument as well. So let me again play the devil's advocate so in turn we can become better apologists in defense of marriage. What about people who would say, okay, if children are the end result of a union between a man and a woman, same-sex couples can adopt, aren't we not part of the greater good because we're taking a child that needs a home, providing a home? It's just that it happens to be two people of the same sex. Are we not fulfilling that same directive, that mandate, that role in society?
Well, there are two ways to respond to that. The first is to say that what every child deserves, you know, really as a matter of justice, what every child has a right to, is to be raised by the man and the woman that created them, by a mother and a father. And that the only time when that shouldn't take place is when, for some reason, that man and that woman are incapacitated or they're incompetent, or, you know, they're unwilling, they're abusive, you know, something's gone wrong when it's not that child's mother and father that's taking care of them. So then when we say, all right, well, now we need to find some substitutionary institution, the ideal substitute for that is still going to be a mother and a father, because there's no such thing as parenting in the abstract. Men and women are different. And as a result, mothering and fathering are different. And you can think about this. Let's say you have a child wrestling with a parent on the living room floor. Which parent's more likely to be wrestling on the floor with the child?
Exactly.
And what is being taught to that child? You know, so let's say it's, you know, the father wrestling with a son on the living room floor. The father's teaching the son how to be aggressive, how to be masculine, but how not to be violent. So he'll teach the kid, don't bite, don't pull hair, don't gouge eyes. Because, you know, when you get frustrated, you know, when your dad's beating you up a little bit on the living room floor, you're tempted to pull his hair or to bite him or to scratch him, you know, to be violent. So one of the things that we saw is that families that have absentee dads, there's a greater likelihood of crime in that family. You know, there's a less likelihood that that son will be raised to maturity without a mix-up with the police. Because one of the things that dads do is they help little boys grow into mature men. Because fathers and mothers are different. This isn't to say that, you know, this can't happen with single mothers. And it's not to say that they're not heroic. Single mothers are heroic. But it is to say that the ideal isn't just two parents, but it's a mother and a father. And so another problem with redefining marriage to exclude sexual complementarity is that the law teaches. And one of the things that the law will be teaching if we redefine marriage is that mothers and fathers as an ideal don't even matter. It's really just two parents or two pocketbooks or, you know, two sources of income, something like that. But marriage, as it's been properly understood, is really about men and women, husbands and wives, mothers and fathers. There's nothing magical about the number two. The only reason the number two came up was precisely because of the sexual difference and complementarity of men and women.
All right. So now, and again, playing the devil's advocate so we can learn, let's look at a couple that cannot have children or choose not to have children or are an older couple who get married. Can that be an argument to say, well, you can't validate that relationship as the only modality because they're not going to produce offspring, so your whole argument about raising children is negated by their circumstances?
Sure. So, you know, we have a half of our one of our chapters is on, you know, these two objections being the interracial marriage objection and the infertility objection. And we respond to that. I hear the music coming on, so maybe we have to save that for after the break.
Yeah, you're good, Ryan. Yes, please. It's too crucial to cram it in before we get to the break. So let me take a break and come right back with Ryan Anderson, who's at the Heritage Foundation, one of the authors of this marvelous book called What is Marriage? Man and Woman, a Defense. How to be able to think just in terms of history, the preponderance of evidence out there in society, so that when you go out in the marketplace and people go, well, what difference does it make? This book is filled with all kinds of what difference it makes. Check it out at our website, inthemarketwithjanetparshall.org. It's on the right-hand side. I sincerely hope that this program has helped you in some way today. And if it has, please tell a friend and encourage them to listen to it as well. This and other programs that have aired in the past year are freely available to listen to online at inthemarketwithjanetparshall.org. Programs older than that are also available for purchase at moodyaudio.com. And thanks again for listening. What is Marriage? Man and Woman, a Defense. It's a brand new book that is co-authored by Ryan Anderson, who's our guest. Ryan is at the Heritage Foundation. He's one of the authors of this important book. And I want to get right back to the question, if I may, just out of deference to time, Ryan. So if children are one of the key and important reasons why the state should have a vested interest in marriage being defined, as God always defined it, one man and one woman, so I'm putting out some of the straw man arguments. All right, a couple that can't have kids, chooses not to have kids, or is an older couple. Doesn't that invalidate the necessity of saying marriage should be a man and a woman because children are a potential result?
No. So the, you know, the argument we make, and it's in one of the latter chapters where we respond to that objection, to the interracial marriage objection, and we say that the reason that the state cares about marriage is because the marital relationship can result in new human life and that kids need moms and dads. But that marriage understood as a human good, understood as an institution that is perfective of human nature and that actually creates human flourishing, isn't just about baby making. And that you have a wrong understanding of what marriage is if you think it's just about procreation. You know, marriage is about the love between a man and a woman. And in particular, in the way that a man and a woman can unite because of their sexual differences. Because of the sexual complementarity of man and woman, they actually form what we call a comprehensive union, both a union of mind and heart, but also a union of body. And that this is good in and of itself. But then the reason that the state cares about this union is that the majority of them frequently produce kids. So the state is interested at the wholesale level, not the retail level. And that it would actually, if the state only kind of granted marriage certificates to marriages that produced kids, it would actually teach something false about what marriage is. Because it would be teaching that marriage is only about reproduction rather than what it really is about, which is a comprehensive union of man and woman, comprehensive union of spouses, which frequently is reproductive in fact, not just in potential, and that's why the state recognizes it. But it's a wholesale versus retail distinction as to why public policy gets in on this. But the nature of the human good is about how men and women can unite and form a community based upon their differences.
Ren, let me, if I again, and I could, I'm sorry I didn't allocate an hour for this because it's such a crucial conversation. I want to go to another component, one that I think is very, very important. And I think more and more of our friends are beginning to understand the potential of radically redefining marriage, particularly as this works its way slowly to the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court. You have a section on there on how this has a real threat toward moral and religious freedom. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, if you don't mind, there's a great, you know, the state of Illinois right now is debating redefining marriage. You know, this is going on right now in the state capitol there. And the Catholic bishop of Springfield, the capital of Illinois, wrote a letter about this last week where he goes on to talk precisely about the religious liberty aspect. Because the title of the bill, it's disingenuously titled the Religious Freedom Protection and Marriage Act, right?
Yes.
And Marriage Fairness Act. You know, they even threw that in, the Religious Freedom and Marriage Fairness Act. But here's what he writes. He says, "The pending bill is not only a dangerous social experiment about marriage, it's also a lethal attack upon religious liberty. This so-called religious freedom would not stop the state from obligating the Knights of Columbus to make their halls available for same-sex weddings. It would not stop the state from requiring Catholic grade schools to hire teachers who are legally married to someone of the same sex. The bill would not protect Catholic hospitals, charities, or colleges, which exclude those so married from senior leadership positions. Nor would it protect me, the Bishop of Springfield, if I refuse to employ someone in a same-sex marriage who applied to the diocese for a position meant to serve my ministry as bishop." And he goes on and on, and he even points out that this would do, the bill would do nothing at all to protect the consciences of people in business or who work for the government. So one way to think about this is, if you think the HHS mandate, you know, the abortion pill, the contraceptive mandate, is an infringement of religious liberty, redefining marriage will be much worse. First, because it'll make the job of the church that much difficult. The law can either make it easier for the church to teach the truth about marriage, or it can make it more difficult. But then also there'll be legal penalties. So a year ago, Illinois passed a Civil Union Act, and it was titled the Religious Freedom Protection and Civil Union Act. And a couple months later, Catholic Charities, their adoption services, were forced out of business because they only wanted to place children with adoptive moms and dads. They thought that a child that was an orphan deserved a mom and a dad. And the state said, no, that's discriminatory. You can't treat people differently based upon whether they're in a civil union or in a marriage. And so they were shut down. And so he goes on and he says, these aren't just kind of a flaw of the bill. He said, there's no possible way, none whatsoever, for those who believe that marriage is exclusively the union of a husband and wife to avoid legal penalties and harsh discriminatory treatment if this bill becomes law. Why should we expect it to be otherwise? After all, we would be people who, according to this bill, hold on to an unfair view of marriage. The state would have equated our view with bigotry, which it uses the law to marginalize in every way short of criminal punishment. So that's what's at stake here. And that's a lot at stake when you think that marriage is the center of civilization.
Yes.
And that view is going to be taught in law as bigotry.
So, Ryan, on that note, and what a perfect point to take us to next, let me go back to where you started, which is arguing not the empathetic argument, but arguing the objective argument. The evidence that says better for the child, poverty eradication, less juvenile delinquency, the list goes on and on and on and on. But I see a parallel here that so often this gets argued not objectively, but empathetically. And I see a parallel with the embryonic stem cell argument. Who cares if you have to destroy a child? Don't you understand I've been promised a cure for juvenile diabetes? I don't care if I might have to take a preborn child, if you call that a living human being. I might be able to deal with my MS. The same argument I see being woven here, because people will say, what difference does it make to you who I love? Just stay out of my relationship. It's not going to hurt you in any way. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, well, so the argument that we make is that redefining marriage to exclude the norm of sexual complementarity will also weaken the other norms about marriage, the norm about monogamy, the norm of sexual exclusivity, and the norm about permanency. And increasingly, the leading advocates of redefining marriage own up to this. It's just that they think it's a good thing. They think getting rid of those other requirements will liberate us. We think that it will lead to our ruin.
Yes, and I heartily concur. Ryan, absolutely fascinating discussion. And folks, there is oh so much more in the book. Again, not arguing this biblically, but arguing to someone who rejects that completely, rejects a biblical worldview. This is a wonderful way to simply say, look at history, look at the evidence that's out there that says man and woman is the definition of a marriage can be heartily defended, and the evidence comes down in our favor. We've put the book on the right-hand side of our website at inthemarketwithjanetparshall.org. And in the meantime, Ryan's good. I told you he'd be good. I want you to know some of the other work that he's doing as the William E. Simon Fellow in Religion and Free Society at the Heritage Foundation. So we've hot-linked the website for you to learn more about Ryan Anderson. My thanks to Ryan and to you, friends. We'll see you next time on In the Market with Janet Parshall.
Here's one more Bible study tip from pastor and Bible teacher John MacArthur.
I believe every Christian should read through the Old Testament once a year. Yes, that sounds like a big commitment, but if you spend at least 20 minutes every day, you should get through it within a year. As you read, be sure to write notes in the margins, highlighting the passages you don't understand. And as you read and reread the scriptures, you'll be amazed how many of those passages suddenly become clearer.
Moody Radio wants to help you get more from your Bible study. We'll send you a copy of John MacArthur's book, How to Study the Bible, for a gift of any amount to Moody Radio. Please call 800-400-7022. That's 800-400-7022. Or go online to moodyradioresource.org. That's moodyradioresource.org. How to Study the Bible by John MacArthur. Call or click with your gift to Moody Radio today.
Thank you for listening to this edition of In the Market with Janet Parshall. I again want to remind you that if you'd like to come alongside us and help with the financial costs associated with this program, you can support us by visiting moodyradio.org and clicking on Support Moody. Again, that's moodyradio.org. Thanks again, friend, and we hope to see you next time.